From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Andrew the Triforce Howard. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Shout out to whatever social media app you're on right now. If you're in a chat, tell them you're listening to our show. You know what I mean? Why not weaponize it?
Oh, man, you might as well. It's already weaponized against us.
Yeah.
Might as well turn the tables, flip the script.
Yes, yes. Just so we were talking about this just a little bit off air. A question I've been asking a lot of people recently: what is the longest you have gone without checking your phone?
No more than a day. I mean, a day is nearly impossible. I fully copped offline to being an absolute phone junkie, and I've had to initiate some kind of self-imposed phone restrictions, like keeping it charging in a different room while I do things around the house or work on projects. But I'm absolutely addicted to the damn thing.
Yeah, we're going to talk about an author, Johan Hari, who did a little experiment with that whole thing. But when I think about vacations I've taken with my son or my family, those are the times I've put it away the most. But I am still constantly checking for work stuff, checking for conversations in a text thread, checking social media performance of a video, all that stuff.
And shout out to Hari. Graceland doesn't make it easier either. I think we're talking about the same article there too. For a lot of us, or I should answer this as well, I've been trying, like you guys, to be more intentional about this. I think for a lot of us in the audience tonight, technically the longest you've been without your phone was the first few years of childhood and adolescence before you got your own phone, right? Well,
and now it's like you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Kids expect to get a phone at a certain age. If they don't have one, they feel excluded. It's nigh impossible to deprive them of that. You almost would be looked at as some sort of monster by society. How dare you not give your kid a phone at age 13 or whatever?
You'd be in an out group, and that's not good for social networking. Quick question, just curious here. What's the going wisdom now for parents on the appropriate age for a kid to have some kind of phone, even if it's restricted access like a learner phone?
Yeah, Matt, wouldn't you say that there's always the argument of safety? That does seem to be a thing that comes up. And then, of course, all the other stuff that follows along, because you can't really, you know, pick and choose. Once they have the thing, they kind of have the thing. But what's your philosophy on that?
Well, we are all connected, and you do want to know where your child is, right? And we have these institutional programs like school and daycare that you send your child to, and you just trust that the adults in those places are doing their jobs and doing them well. But in the times between, it is weird to think about the transit between school and wherever they're going to, or, you know, that as they get a little older, going to a friend's house, you want to be able to connect to them. And if they don't have a personalized device, we don't have landlines in houses anymore. You can't call Chris's house anymore and say, "Hey, Chris, is my son doing okay?" But I guess you could call the parent, which is nice. But yeah, so sorry, long-winded answer, just to say, I think as soon as a child can kind of go out and do things on their own, you are going to want, as a parent, to have some sort of direct connection to them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a solid rubric. You know, in most countries, it's absolutely normal to constantly refer to your phone. And I love the point you made, Noel, that there are safety concerns too. We're talking about people growing up, moving into the wide world. For some of us adults, you might constantly need to do it for your job, emails, text, right? Like you were saying, Matt, a ton of people are constantly clicking on social media apps, your TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, X, Snapchat, WeChat, all the apps. Reddit is social media as well. And it's weird how quickly it became normalized. We have to remember, being normal doesn't necessarily mean a thing is good. So as we're looking into in tonight's episode, there are serious concerns that social media has become a kind of whoosh, whoosh, accidental conspiracy against your brain, particularly your attention span.
I'm sorry, what?
Right. I get it. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
You've heard about the Super Bowl's legendary pregame tailgate party, where the biggest stars in music kick off football's biggest game. iHeartRadio is bringing the show to your radio for the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert, starring Post Malone, live from New Orleans, Super Bowl Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 Pacific. Watch on YouTube at youtube.com/NFL and hear it on the new and improved free iHeartRadio app, the exclusive audio home of the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert.
Here are the facts. I guess first we have to explain the term social media. It seems like it came out of the blue, you know, and no one really questioned what it was because we all understood what it was. But I think it's worth us digging into it just a little.
For sure. Social media is something we've covered a lot on this show, and it is weird to think that the text app on your phone is kind of social media. A little bit. The email, Gmail, that's kind of social media. But a lot of companies, individuals, figured out ways to connect human beings even closer to, basically, it's all a conspiracy to make you overshare on the internet and then get some attention for oversharing.
Well, yeah, I mean, the currency is your time, and these apps are designed and psychologically designed to make you spend as much time as humanly possible. And, you know, this is capitalizing on a very common human need, the idea to have a peer group, the idea to be connected with others, making clubs, for example. We've been doing that since, you know, time immemorial. For most of human history, people have gathered in groups of shared interests, like-minded individuals, you know, chopping it up, sharing ideas.
Yes, I love that point, Noel. Social media and social networking are Venn diagrams. They're two related, overlapping, yet distinct concepts because, as you said, people have been social networking since the days of tribes, right? What do we have in common? And the first thing was, the thing we have in common is we're related and we want to survive. The only thing that has changed about social networking as a group of tactics over time was what a given group prioritizes. Your tribe, your religion, the state, a career interest, who you want to date, etc. And then when we see the advent of the age of information, mass communication technology, now social networking just has new vectors, the in-group, the out-group. That's not going to change for the foreseeable future. Social networking is a way to build communities. Social media is a way to build an audience, or that's why a lot of people are there. The platforms need the user-generated content for now, until the AI slops through, and those users are often hoping to garner the largest audience possible, which can then be monetized.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we're almost entering an era where social media celebrities are more powerful or just as powerful than traditional celebrities, movie stars, absolutely, pop stars. I mean, yeah, a certain generation cares way more about YouTubers and Instagram influencers than they do about, you know, film actors, for example.
Yeah. You don't have to look far to see the sudden sea change here. I think about this whenever I'm doing a career day. Children of past generations, you know, wanted to be president or a famous athlete, right? I want to be the next LeBron or the next Michael Jordan. I want to be a rock star. More and more kids now dream of being a social media celebrity or an influencer. And there was a really interesting series of studies, one by a group called Morning Consult, that found social media star is the fourth most popular career aspiration for kids these days.
Yeah, it makes sense. My kid saw our George Washington videos, and after that, we had a couple more talks about what he really likes, what he's into, and he said, I want to make videos like you, Dad. And I went, oh, crap.
And I think it's sort of easy to be dismissive of influencers and social media stars and all of that. But, you know, we can tell you firsthand that there's a lot of work that goes into it. It does require a constant vigilance of posting and creating content and kind of never sleeping on it, because you can lose that audience as quickly as you can gain it. But there is a certain sense of frivolousness around this type of celebrity, I would argue. It's like you're famous for being famous, you know?
Yeah, Kardashian level, right, is the argument there.
In the end, it depends on what ideas you're putting forth into the world, right? What ideas do you generate in the people that look at your 60-second video? And often it is, as you know, we kind of slid that in there, that is about monetization. Social media influencers get used as a way to have ads get thrown in people's faces, even if they don't realize it.
There was a great South Park episode about that, a real brutal one. I don't know if you guys remember. And I also love the point that, yeah, it can seem frivolous to some generations or some demographics, but it makes sense to aspire to these digital heights. You know, for a lot of younger folks, most of the success stories you see, most of the media you encounter, it's on a platform you enjoy. It's, you know, a Twitch streamer you really like. Or if you're into aviation, you can go to a certain agglomeration of hashtags and you can meet tons of people who will give you short form, dense, accurate, scientific information about aviation. So we're not trying to throw the digital baby out with the bathwater, but it's so weird. This is a funny story. Did you guys know nobody knows who made up the phrase social media?
I guess I would have thought that it would have been associated with somebody, like a coined kind of moment, but
some kind of influencer maybe.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's pretty cut and dry though, right? I mean, media, it is a medium. It is the conduit for digital socialization. So certain terms like that just kind of almost invent themselves, like with a form of parallel thinking.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way to put it. If we go to some great conversations, Forbes journalist Jeff Bercovici had, he talked to a lot of tech executives from the 90s, right? The days when AOL was still sending you a CD so you didn't run out of internet. And one of the most prominent contenders claiming to create the phrase social media is Tina Sharkey, who was a former executive at iVillage and AOL and babycenter.com. And she described it kind of the way you said, Noel, when she's talking to this journalist back in 2010. She says, it's not service media. It's not quite informational media. It's social media. It wasn't media we were creating. It was media we were facilitating. And I think that's a big point, right? Because you are, if you are using these products, you are making the stuff that they want to cycle through in between the ads.
So that's like in the 90s, 94-ish times?
Yeah, that's when she's saying it. We know the origin, if you look at OED, we know the origin starts popping up in the early 90s. No one's quite sure when. And probably one of the, I know you guys love this, one of the favorite contenders for the crown of coining social media is another AOL guy, or a couple of them, Ted Leonis, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, and Steve Case. They said they were throwing it around, and Ted has the best line, where he says, yeah, if it really mattered, I'm sure we could find a deck somewhere that talked about social networking and social media from that time. But what does it matter?
Okay, weird flex, Steve. Yeah. Well, sorry, deck, Ted.
Just for anybody who doesn't know, a deck is like a PowerPoint presentation
slideshow kind
of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, techie kind of business type presentations. He's basically saying, we did it, but I'm not going to lie. It's not worth my time to show the receipts. You know what I mean?
There's another guy named Daryl Berry that has a kind of a similar thing. He's like, yeah, we were throwing around the term back in the day, around 94. I think everybody was.
Yeah. And these folks are right, by the way. There is no official award for coining that phrase. It's ubiquitous. Nobody owns it. What you get are bragging rights. But still, a rose is a rose is a rose, right? Social media, whatever you call it, is one of the most successful communication phenomena in all of human history. And you don't have to look far to see it. The statistics are crazy. And we're also, all of us, in full disclosure, recording this now. We are part of those statistics, folks.
Hell, man. The app we use to record could in some way be considered like a facilitator of social media, at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's count that app, Riverside, in this conversation. As of October...
Guys, was Dungeons & Dragons the first social media?
I think letter writing was maybe the
first. It's a media.
I don't know, man.
It could be classwalls.com. Yeah. That's sure. Yeah. I guess, yeah, we don't have to. We should then carve out the definition. We're talking about current electronic social media that uses the internet. If you're looking at that, then I don't think this statistic surprises anybody. As of October 2024, kind of the best time we have recent numbers for, there were 5.52 billion people somehow using the internet across the globe. That's more than two-thirds of the global population overall.
Well, it's interesting, too, because in the really early days, AOL-type days that we're talking about, I remember having a friend whose mom was super online, early adopter, and she was into all of these kind of chat rooms. And there was this whole this thing called the Palace that I remember, where you could have a little avatar that you could create with, like, a rudimentary photo editing, you know, Photoshop-type graphic editing app. And they were all just, like, these little avatars on these backgrounds. They were, like, kind of like, you know, think of, like, wallpaper, like, old-school, like, desktop wallpaper, but it was like, you know, some sort of weird Clue style mansion, and they would theme different rooms, a tiki party, whatever the heck. And you would be these little JPEGs, and there would be speech bubbles coming out of your, you know, little JPEG. And that was a form of social media, but it was a lot more niche, and you had to kind of be in the know to find those groups.
Mm, yeah. I remember Ultima Online in 1997. When I could chat and hang out with my friends in an online environment.
That was a game, right?
Yes. And we could hunt monsters together.
Fun.
Yeah. And I remember earlier things like the BBS stuff, the bulletin boards.
Right.
Where you would post for specific forums. And a lot of those got weird. You know what I mean? This is all precedential, right? This is sets a precedent for the more than 5.20 billion users of social media networks across the globe. So the vast majority of people who are on the internet in the first place are on a social media network. That's 60 to 64% of the entire human population. And no matter what people might say about, hey, I'm quitting Meta or whatever, those numbers keep on rising year after year after year.
Do you think that accounts for individual users or people who have, you know, different social media accounts or, you know, like somebody who has two or three Facebook accounts or somebody who has, you know, multiple Instagrams or multiple. I wonder if you could figure that out.
Depend on the nature of the metric, like who's doing the measuring. Like if it's an industry thing, then it would probably benefit the industry to count each of those as separate, like the way downloads are counted kind of unusually in podcasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cough, cough. I didn't pull the specific numbers from like a marketing place because to your point, Noel, I think they would be more incentivized or a private company would be more incentivized to, as Homer Simpson said, embiggen their numbers. So I believe this statistic is just counting individual people no matter how many accounts they have. So one tick mark is a person with five different Instagram accounts or five different Reddit accounts where they argue with each other, and it's counting them the same as one person who just has their one Snapchat or what have you.
Still a pretty staggering number, however it's counted. Mm-hmm. I think people should try to be more like Christopher Walken. Have you seen the news making the rounds lately? He's never owned a cell phone. He doesn't have any streaming. He has to watch episodes of Succession on like DVDs that they send him in the mail. I don't know. There's something charming now about that kind of unplugged, off the grid attitude, because it is increasingly more and more difficult to accomplish and to just not be kind of like ostracized by society.
Yeah, it also gives him, it gives us a chance to shout out Christopher Walken. You know, good on you for getting on board with DVDs, man.
For sure. Keeping physical media alive.
Also, well, for him, it might be new. He might have said, look, a VHS was good enough for me. Yeah,
this is the only new piece of technology that I will touch. And a great dancer, that guy.
Mm-hmm. And look, for some of us, this massive proliferation of social media and online existence is great. Podcasters are part of that. It guarantees folks like us can have increasing potential avenues for sharing our work. The nutso thing is that all of the big social media apps or platforms kind of have their own shiny statistics and specialities, right? We know that Facebook, even though here in the US, a lot of us might say, Facebook, that's for old people. It has the lion's share of active social media users. If you're just, again, going one person counts for whatever they're doing, it has 3.07 billion active users across the globe in 2024. Matt, again, we'd have to get under the hood of the metrics. That's pretty impressive, but the methodology could be suspect. And that's not for Instagram. That's just for Facebook. And we have to remember, especially in developing countries, Facebook is the internet. A lot of people are only interacting on their, I have it, of course, right by me. A lot of people are only interacting on their phone, and they're only really going to stuff through Facebook.
Well, yeah, Facebook is the first one that popped up and got so popular, and it became a place for families to connect. I know my family used that way. A lot of my friends, they still keep up with their families via Facebook. I know that using that, like if I jump on and check it, and I don't do it very often, there are people that I went to high school with that are still on Facebook, active, doing that thing. And it is so strange for me, just because I gave up that ship a long time ago, because I kind of felt like I had to. And it's exactly what we're talking about today, the addictive nature of this stuff and where your attention goes. But it does feel like you will be missing out if you do not have a Facebook account to keep up with the folks that you knew around the time when Facebook came about.
I keep the Messenger app on my phone just in case somebody who's more of a Facebook person hits me up that way. But I don't ever look at it. I've exclusively kind of migrated to Instagram, which is more of like a visual form, I guess, of social media, which I enjoy. I follow a lot of like graphic artists and designers and things like that. But there's also a lot of good reposts from other social media platforms that end up on there. But of course, it's also owned and operated by Meta. Right. So,
And it just feels like one of those things that has been around for so long, that's why their numbers are so crazy. It's not because it's superior or something like that. It has just been around. It kind of reminds me of the stuff shows.
And just to add to like the personal experiences that we're sharing here, I don't trust Messenger enough to have it on any phone that I would use. So I keep one computer with desktop access to Facebook and Messenger. And I'm a little sour on it too, man. It's a first to the post thing, but also you kind of have to thread that needle of you want to meet people where they're at, right? If there's a loved one that is more active on this thing and you worry about them or you want to check in with them, then you naturally are going to go the easiest route, right? The best way to find them and interact with them. So there's a give and take to all of these things. For example, TikTok has only 900 million users in 2024, but those users spend an average of 58 minutes and 24 seconds on it every 24 hours. That works out to 23 hours, 30 minutes or so each month. Again, it's a wide ballpark average, but that's almost a full day out of each month when you add it up.
Yeah. I am no exception. I don't use TikTok, but I definitely scroll some Instagram reels and stories, pretty chronically. And when you do see that screen time adding up, if you dare to check the stats on your device, it can be pretty staggering.
pretty harrowing, especially if you're 22% of U.S. teens who spend 2 to 3 hours per day on average on TikTok. Look, on the surface, is a huge success story, right? Now, imagine we're social media execs. Our platform has replaced so much older media for other people. TV, radio, long-form film, reading, newspapers. But the problem is, for the critics, the way that they teach you to encounter, interrogate, and digest information. So the big question, could regular social media use, like we all do, could it actually make you less intelligent?
Well, we'll find out after a quick word from our sponsors.
You've heard about the Super Bowl's legendary pregame tailgate party where the biggest stars in music kick off football's biggest game. iHeartRadio is bringing the show to your radio for the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert starring Post Malone live from New Orleans. Super Bowl Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 Pacific. Watch on YouTube at youtube.com/NFL and hear it on the new and improved free iHeartRadio app, the exclusive audio home of the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert.
Here's where it gets crazy. Collective sigh of relief at our cliffhanger there. No, it's not going to automatically knock your IQ down 20 points or whatever.
Not like no. the long-term effects of lead exposure to the Roman Empire.
But it can make you less effective. Yep. At using your intelligence.
Mm-hmm. It can knock down your performance on tests, including IQ tests, for sure. It's because it appears to have, over time, clear and damaging effects on things like comprehension, memory retention, and most troublingly, and most well-researched at this point, attention span.
Well, the thing about social media in that respect is, at least as far as I'm concerned, is it sort of promotes this idea that you can do all the things at one time,
right,
equally well. And that's just not true. It's this like myth, this kind of lie that we've been sold that you can like multitask by, you know, looking, having 50 tabs open, looking at different articles and also scrolling your social media and watching a movie in the background. And the reality is we only have a finite amount of attention to give. And when we start cutting it and cutting it and cutting it, it's almost like we're not giving anything to any one thing. It's all so far flung that we're kind of not really doing anything. It's like a jack of all trades, master of none kind of mentality.
Yeah, well said. Do you want to, and we'll get into that further in depth in a little bit. Noel, do you want to introduce us to Tessa Nussenbaum?
Absolutely. Writing for The Standard in December of 2023, like so many other folks over the past few decades, she anecdotally noticed something kind of disturbing, that she was having a hard time reading, researching, and writing. Just every couple of minutes, it would seem, she had almost unconsciously this urge to stop what she was working on, actively working on, pick up her phone for a quick break, you know, mm-hmm. And then boom, before you know it, you're just locked into that doom scroll.
Yeah, and let's talk about why this is so important, coming from Tessa specifically. She is writing for The Standard, which is a school paper for the American School in London, which means that she is a student giving you direct like access to basically a teenager's mind as they are going through this. And it's a teenager that's intelligent enough to write this kind of paper and have the self-awareness, right, as she's actively going through it. It's not, no offense, guys, it's not us looking back on our teenage years and thinking about it. This is somebody in that moment knowing what it feels like.
In situ, immediate arrest. Yeah, and no matter what Nussenbaum does, no matter how many times she attempts to scope in and focus, she finds she continually returns back to the apps before any significant amount of time has passed. So this leads her on a disturbing journey of discovery, and it's one that we see echoed by multiple other students, multiple other journalists, as well as a small army of researchers, marketers, and academics, and of course, social media giants. This is what you find from all these reports, anecdotal and quantitative. Social media is purposely designed to be addictive. You didn't get a dopamine rush from that last post or reel or interaction. That, you know, that singing raven didn't quite do it for you, no worries. Don't bother thinking too deeply. There's a shiny other video about a raven. It's also short. Just scroll down.
So much good Corvid content. I mean, you know what it reminds me of, guys, is the time that we all went to Vegas together and sort of, you know, strolled the casino floors. And honestly, I got sucked in to some of those bright and shiny and noisy video, you know, gambling machines. It's a very similar thing. You're chasing that win. You're chasing that the sound effects and the you know, the graphics that explode across the screen. It's very similar to chasing that piece of content. Content that scratches just that right psychological itch.
You could call it over-simulation.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It's rapid fire novelty.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. There's something to that.
Mm-hmm. And it's not how the human brain evolved to digest information. Not necessarily, not at this level and not at this cadence. When you don't have access to frenetic, fast-moving cavalcades, this endless ephemera, that's what a lot of it is, right? Mixed in with things of note. Then you're forced to really think about information you encounter. You analyze it. You synthesize it. You digest. You connect it with other pieces of information you've encountered and assimilated before. That's why you're able to think more critically. It also allows you the superpower of sniffing out false claims and BS. It's pretty big, and it's a muscle, right? That's only a cliche because it's true. Your brain is a collection of different cognitive muscles. What happens when this set of muscles, the ability to analyze and exercise critical thought, what happens when it gets atrophied or muted? You get a processing issue.
Right. Well, you're not actually doing anything. I mean, you mentioned the word simulation, Ben. It's like it's simulation. You know, you're actually just getting all of this. You're living this whole kind of internal, you know, life without leaving your couch or without looking up from your phone. So it's almost like you're living, but not really living. It's a very matrixy kind of, you know, proposition.
Mm. It also codifies the ways in which you can participate in information, right? The ways you can respond to a thing. And you have, you know, like, yeah, comment, etc. You don't have the same ability to imagine or interrogate a response as you would if you were, say, reading a book.
Well, yeah. Think about how exciting that activity is, right? Having something new hit your face, your mind, your ears, everything, your, you know, your eyes that quickly, something new, something different. Every time you do it, take one little action with your finger and something new happens.
You don't have to work for it. You don't have to like really put in that much effort. It's just kind of right there presented to you on a silver platter, and it learns what you like too. Sorry.
Wild. Yeah, you're right. But that versus, as you're saying, Ben, reading a book, sitting there and going through words and synthesizing those words into ideas and thoughts and images in your own head, those two things compared, one is so easy and exciting. The other could be exciting if you really thought about it, but it is less exciting on the surface, and the immediacy of the excitement that you get isn't there when you're thinking about a book or doing chores or, you know, just doing anything else.
Yeah. Let's talk about this as we hone in on that. There's a somewhat controversial study, or people will tell you it's controversial, in 2015 by the eggheads of Microsoft, and they found the following. You can clock an overall trend as we step through this. In the year 2000, it's still awkward to say that. That's what I always think about. Yeah. I feel like you need to add something on there. Anyway, the straight up 2000, Microsoft found the average human attention span, in their estimation, was 12 seconds. That does not sound impressive, honestly. So try it at home, turn on a timer, don't look at anything, don't listen to anything. Maybe just close your eyes and breathe. Wait and see how long 12 seconds really is. Which is why we're not going to do it on the show, because we hate dead air. 12 seconds is so long for us. That's the idea I had originally, yeah.
I think you should use your original idea.
Let's meditate, guys. Let's take a come on. It's the least we can do. We owe it to David Lynch, okay? In his memory, let's meditate for 12 seconds.
We should put some sound in there, right?
All right.
Ocean waves, perhaps.
Andrew, I'll count down from three, and then I get to one. Give us a beep. I'll start a timer here for 12 seconds.
If you're driving, obviously, you know, maintain your
eyes. Keep your eyes open. Yeah. All right. Do this when you're not operating machinery. All right. 3, 2, 1.
Interminable. God, what a waste of time. No, I'm kidding. It's important. Stillness is important. Mindfulness is important. We have to claw that back into our lives.
How long did that 12 seconds feel for you, folks? Assuming you weren't, you know, hopping on your phone. How did your thoughts fly in that short length of time? It's interesting, especially we consider, again, the Microsoft study, which people say is imperfect. In 2013, the same study found the average attention span had dropped down to 8 seconds. As Nussbaum pointed out, and as a lot of other people clocked as well, according to Microsoft, that attention span was shorter than that of the average goldfish. These little lunatics can stay focused on something for about 9 seconds if it interests them.
Isn't that
like if it's food?
Ted Lasso thing, be a goldfish. The idea of, like, you know, that is as a superpower, not a bug, you know, be able to like clear your mind and not remember the past.
Which is maybe good advice. It depends. You know, there are other studies that find different specific nuts and bolts numbers, but they all kind of map out that same trend. Like Dr. Gloria Mark, you can read her work, and you can also listen to a couple of podcasts she's done. She found that in 2004, the average attention to just any kind of screen was about 2 minutes and 30 seconds. And then years after that, it declined to like 75 seconds. And then by about 2023 to 2024, the number dropped to 45 seconds. So much less weird, right? But also still the same trend.
Well, let's talk about just reading an article that is on a phone or on a screen of any kind. Like when we're doing our research, think back 10 years ago, guys. Think about the ads that would show up if you were reading an article on a place like CNN or Fox News, any of that stuff. Think about the ad space that would be taken up on the screen and how it functioned on that screen.
Sure.
Then think back to early, you know, if you were on AOL News or something, like when you're getting a full article that you're reading. The experience, at least in my mind, was that of reading a book with every once in a while an ad showing up on the sides, on the rails, or an ad showing up in the center between paragraphs, but every once in a while.
Not inundated all around. Not where you had to actually search for the thing you were trying to read on the page.
Yes. Not only that, though. I mean, it just feels like the content has just overall been tailored to that experience and just gotten shorter. Like each piece of content is an ad in and of itself. And rather than having like long form writing and journalism, obviously there's still folks out there that do that. It's about having tons of little nuggety bits to serve those ads.
Well, okay, so I would just
nuggety
really,
bits.
Sorry.
but just, I had that experience reading a Guardian article today where this article was written by Johan Hari that we mentioned at the top of the show. Yeah. It is written in actual paragraphs. And then I realized, why does this feel so strange to me? Because I then looked at some of the other articles that I had open my other tabs, and they are literally sentences, then a break, then sentence, then a break, then a break, then a break, after sentence after sentence. And these companies, a lot of them, are putting ads between every third sentence or something. Mm-hmm. And in the paragraphs, you get at least 3 or 4 paragraphs before you get an ad break. And just the way content is being tailored to it's not to make you understand the concepts that are written in the article or anything like that. It is to get those ads hitting your face as rapidly as they can. And you only, if you can break it up by sentence, you only need, you know, 3 or 4 paragraphs worth of thought in order to sell the same number of ads that this huge Johan Hari article had.
Yeah, and that's why some people will go toward ad blockers, which becomes its own argument, right? Because then are you making it ultimately impossible for those journalists to do that same level of work, you know,
Exactly.
Well, and it also creates an environment where there are fewer, and maybe this is just conjecture on my part, but it would seem that it creates an environment where the demand for that real hard-hitting long-form stuff, at least online, yeah, is significantly diminished because it does not fit that newer rubric to maximize sales dollars.
Do you mean demand from an audience or readers, or do you mean demand from corporations?
Corporations, the people that are paying the journalists, the people that are filling the pipes.
Yeah. Well, in the ads, just one last thing here, the ads are not your standard 2008, you know, a picture, right, that has some information on it that is trying to sell a product.
Autoplay sound videos.
It's like scrolling through social media as those ads load and you're going through and trying. Again, CNN, I'm sorry, but I cannot read stuff on your page unless I alter your page so that I can read it. It sucks. Sorry.
And so, no, it's perfect. And it's honest. And going back to what we're saying about, you know, Hari's work, which we'll get into later, and then also Marx's work. Hari is a journalist, right? But heavily researched into this. And as well as, you know, even the controversial Microsoft study, we see that this overall trend has come about. Now, why do the numbers seem to differentiate? And why do we say their commonalities are more powerful than their differences? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsors.
You've heard about the Super Bowl's legendary pregame tailgate party, where the biggest stars in music kick off football's biggest game. iHeartRadio is bringing the show to your radio for the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert, starring Post Malone, live from New Orleans. Super Bowl Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 Pacific. Watch on YouTube at youtube.com/NFL and hear it on the new and improved free iHeartRadio app, the exclusive audio home of the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert.
And we've returned. All right. First, it's important to note, not all of the numbers agree. That's, I would argue, you guys, that's probably likely to the nature of the sample size, the demographics of the people in a sample size, where they are in life, the types of media they are consuming, their education level, and so on. You know, if you went and you asked a group of people who are academics and all they do is study the Old Testament, their attention span ratings are going to be, you know, a little bit higher than average.
But wouldn't you also say that for generations that like grew up completely online, like there's really nothing to measure that change with? It's just digital how their natives. Brains have been wired from the start. And then the question then becomes like, is it just a new way of dividing attention?
Yeah, and you're measuring the effectiveness of the platforms as well with those folks, right?
That's right.
How effective has Instagram become?
Yeah, and you would be able to compare Gen Z. You would just need to take a group of people of the same age who were not from a part of the world where cell phone technology was ubiquitous, right? So you can maybe see it that way, but then it becomes who's going to fund the study.
I guess what I'm saying though is like, you know, my kid is Gen Z and my kid's best friend's got two twin brothers who are the most Gen Alpha kids I've ever seen.
Like digital natives.
Brain rot, digital, exactly. But it's like they are also intensely creative and weird with their creativity. So there's something to be said about that too. Like, I don't want to just completely demonize this stuff and say the kids, there's no hope because of this toxic internet culture. Like, there's something about the way the brain is wired in these folks that are like online from birth that is different and is interesting. I don't know what it means, but I've witnessed it, and there is something going on with these kids.
That's a similar argument to the older one about indigo children, which is a whole different bag of badgers. And also, it's a great setup. It reminds me of the second aspect that we have to talk about with these studies, which is attention is also not necessarily across the brain and across the world hardwired to the media you're encountering so much as it is hardwired to the task at hand. If you like reading in general, you're going to stick with the text longer than someone who doesn't really like reading. If you are playing your favorite video game, you might experience a similar level of focus. If you're studying for a test on a subject that you really dig, then you're probably not going to have as tough a time focusing as in, like, let's say you hate, what's a subject people hate?
Math.
Okay.
I mean, you know, love it. Some people love it, sure, and are great at it. And some people are inherently great at it and has, yes, an aptitude and a type of attention that is very well suited for that kind of analysis. You know, I mean, I know I'm stating the obvious. Some people are better at some things than others, but for me, I'm so bad at math. But when I work on music and I'm engaging with like sound design or synthesis, it's a way of interacting with math, which is a subject that I hate. I just had to find a different path to it, you know?
I just experienced this with my son. We were studying for a test on Indigenous Americans and all the aspects, right? A social studies test that he was working on. And he wanted to sit with me and study and just go over stuff. And he wanted to learn it all. But then we sat down to learn about pollution, and he did not like that subject because it made him feel a little scared and uncomfortable and all of that. So that anxiety that he felt is what caused him to lose focus when we were attempting to study that one. And I wonder if overall generalized anxiety has anything to do with the desire to move to these social media things versus, you know, actually studying what's happening in the news or something like that.
Right. The brain wants to, yes. Yeah. Okay. So here's the idea.
Both the brain and the heart want what they want.
Task accomplishment is really what it is. And the immediate gratification of learning something easy that is not hard, to your brain, you're still accomplishing a task, right? And I think anxiety to that point does play a role in it. I'm not going to get into an anecdote, but I've definitely encountered what you're talking about.
Well, in this case, it was a subject that was hard, that had ton of dense information, but he was into it. And the other thing was a ton of generalized information, but it made him nervous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the idea here regarding anxiety, it kind of speaks to the level of, there are certain things people may be more comfortable learning, right? And the brain hates tackling something and then having to get it wrong and go back and redo it. That's another big part of it. So the brain is naturally incentivized to look for easily accomplishable tasks. And seeing a video and reacting to it and hitting that like button is an easily accomplishable task. And the brain responds and says, boom, we just did something. Here's a little shot of dopamine. Now it's on to another task. We are killing it today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stimulation simulation. It's weird, man. And, you know, and we're all totally subject to it. You know, there's really, it's very hard to escape, you know, short of completely unplugging. And that's just not very practical anymore.
Right. And I wonder, too, if there's some attention span alarmism, right? To which degree is this really affecting people? I mean, is it hyperbolic? Are we overdoing it with concern?
Well, no. I mean, I'm with you, Matt. And I will say that I do have a hard time sitting and focusing and reading a book, reading a novel. We do a ton of short form reading and then papers and things like that for the podcast. But I have really struggled with maybe it's that multitask culture that we sort of become a part of, you know, against our will maybe at times, but that's not great. I'd love to be able to enjoy a book and enjoy a moment of stillness and meditate, but I'm also very high functioning and I enjoy my job and I spend good time with my family and I don't feel like I'm living some sort of existential nightmare. So I don't know. I think results may vary.
I think I've read a little too much Johann Hari. He wrote a book called Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. And I am on board. The guy is arguing basically we need to start a revolution against this stuff, because how do you solve hard problems if you can't focus on a hard problem for years? You know, and I don't know.
Well, would you guys argue that in some small ways, social media could be considered an existential threat?
Yeah.
I would say not to maybe an individual, but to an individual's abilities and perhaps to a civilization's capacities or capabilities.
Yes.
And secondly, are we not, especially in this country, especially with some of the oligarch type situations that are creeping into politics and government, you know, living in a society where the knock-on effects of this stuff are more or less ignored? And the research into how this will affect people down the road is absolutely not part of the conversation when it comes to figuring out how to get the most eyeballs on a product or an advertisement.
Yeah, it's not part of maybe the wider public mainstream conversation, but I do believe the downward trend in attention span does have what we could call knock-on consequences.
Right.
You know, cognitively, look, and I think this is so important because I hate when people are condescending about this kind of stuff. Cognitively, you're not less intelligent for using social media. It is more difficult for you to do certain things, to become engaged in long-term focused or what we call deep thought. We've mentioned it before, but the theory I always like to, I made this up. So okay, you know what? My opinion then, not a theory, unpublished, is if you think of learning on an X and Y axis, learning anything, right? And the Y axis above and below that X, that is the depth of knowledge, right? So the deeper you go on the Y, the more you know about a single thing. The X axis is how many different kinds of things you know. And so the jack of all trades, master of none concept proposed earlier, people used to have very deep knowledge about very specific things. And now we kind of all know the first paragraph of Wikipedia on a thing.
But how does the person who knows the first paragraph on Wikipedia build a rocket? You know,
that's what
like,
I'm saying. Yeah.
I guess what I mean is like, I don't mean to be condescending to anybody, but I do feel like the use of this stuff does cause our intelligence to flatten, maybe like that, the way you're saying, rather than get those spikes that I think humanity needs.
They do, but it's recoverable. And that's why I'm saying, like, your base intelligence has not changed. The ability of engaging with information can be lost and regained, kind of like getting out of shape and then doing your push-ups again.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
It does make complete sense. And again, I would just say, you know, what I was trying to fumble at earlier is like, you know, I definitely think this is something that I need to curtail in my life. And it's something that I am making some steps towards. But I also spent the last like 2.5 days really locked in and focused on working on this remix of a song for my friend's band. And I feel like it's one of the best things I've ever done. And I've like absolutely focused in on every single detail. And I was completely able to stay locked in. So I'm just saying, like,
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I'd love to share it.
And it's task specific again.
That's right.
Something that you care about that already kind of scratches behind your ears cognitively. So you can you can get lost in the sauce of that beautiful moment. You know,
that helps you get the flow state.
The flow zone.
Well, yeah. But that's the thing. Social media simulates a flow state without you actually having to accomplish anything.
Ooh, it's a synthesized flow state.
And the brain is reacting the same way, kind of like how your brain doesn't really, on some levels, doesn't really know the difference between a fake laugh and a real laugh. It encourages some of the same physiological mechanics to occur. That's those feel-good chemicals that you get. We have to tell you, your brain is not the villain here. If anything, your brain is just, again, trying to accomplish checklist and rewarding itself when it feels like a task has been accomplished. So the short-term stuff is immediate. It's the immediate rush of feel-good chemicals as you build a tolerance. But finishing a book, attending a lecture, working on an album, that's a lot more time for that shot of feel-good.
Watching a movie at home without multitasking, without looking at your phone. Executives at Netflix and other streamers have openly talked about, or at least maybe it's more of an open secret kind of thing, that they make movies, they greenlight movies that have a second screen appeal, meaning that you don't have to be locked in because they know 90% or whatever high percentage of viewers are going to be half paying attention and looking at their phones. And I would argue that a lot of that stuff really set in deeply during COVID.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it's also time. Do you have an hour and 45 minutes to dedicate to one thing, to sit in one place and focus on one thing?
Especially when you're fighting a FOMO war on multiple fronts.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It took me three sittings to watch Saturday Night recently. Three sittings. I had to start it, and then I had to stop and go away and do some other stuff because my brain said, "Oh, we got to go do these other things. I can't just sit here and watch a movie."
Yeah. God help us try to get through The Brutalist, y'all.
Right. The last time I watched I was thinking about that too. And I had it somewhere. The last time I watched a film without a second screen was in a theater.
Of course.
Because I didn't want to be rude. No. For another biological comparison, think of it this way. Tell me what you think, guys. I really like this one. I don't know how accurate it is, but lifting from, you know, the old analogy test in LSAT or SAT or whatever, social media is to attention span as smoking is to lung capacity. The more you use the one thing, the more you lose of the other.
Mm.
But you can regain it with a little bit of moderation, a little bit of self-care. So let's talk about these knock-on consequences as your attention span lowers. First, you begin grabbing multiple inputs. And I remember in the brain stuff days, did a video that pissed a lot of people off. It was about multitasking. You're mistaken about it. Nobody can actually multitask. No human being can multitask on these conscious, focused, like pay attention to kind of pursuits, because your brain is already multitasking on keeping your blood flowing, keeping your heart pumping, all this others, making sure you don't automatically crap yourself. Your brain has so much to do, and we don't acknowledge it. When you are trying to focus on conscious things, multiple at once, you're switching your focus. And every time you do this, your brain has a little reset, and it says, oh, what was that thing I was just doing? How did I feel about it? Where did I leave off? What do I want to go to next? That happens every time you're like, let me pick up my phone for a second. Oh, let me get back to this email.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, this technology, I mean, look at like, you know, Apple Vision Pro, whatever, like the idea of having 50 virtual screens surrounding you, you know, Minority Report style. It's this technology and these technology companies that have us believe that this kind of multitasking is possible through technology extensions of our meat bodies. But it's just not true.
Right. Yeah. The average human being absolutely cannot multitask. Your brain is just so good at switching between discrete tasks that from far enough away in your conscious mind, it looks like you're doing it at the same time. Yeah. And that's how the grift works.
Well, it's like having too many tabs open in your browser. All of a sudden, your whole computer crashes.
Well, and every time you switch that task, your brain has to reboot that task. It is not, and that means you have to remember what you were thinking about when you were doing that task, right?
Mm-hmm. Remember what you just did, how you felt about it, and where you left off.
It's almost like existing in this fugue state where you're sort of between things all the time.
I know that feeling specifically when doing the voicemails for this show, where I will get into a minor flow state doing that, and then all of a sudden I have the need to check Instagram, and I do it, and it throws me off completely. And then I will leave and go do something else because I got out of flow state before having to find my way back there somehow.
Mm. Yeah, I think we've all encountered some version of that, all of us in the audience tonight as well. So I want to go back to this Netflix thing, you guys, because this is really, if you notice this, you're not crazy. Noel, you had mentioned it earlier. I think we all clocked it. This is part of why you see more and more characters putting in exposition of what's happening at that moment. And it reminds me a little bit of weird improv, but it's in a very serious way. Someone's going, Ethan, you've just walked in. Yes, and I know about Bolivia, which you mentioned earlier.
Indeed, it's like the way soap operas operate. It is not conducive to good quality writing and art. It's super pandery and like not very interesting, not very creative.
I don't want to accuse people of lazy writing, but it is a way to get stuff across without having to show anybody anything. You just tell them real quick.
Yeah. It also helps, you know, for the people who maybe have a favorite character in an ensemble cast of some sort. Like, let's say there's a modern version of Lost and you only like, I'm trying to remember Lost
Locke.
Characters.
Locke.
The Man in Black or Locke. Yeah, sure. Yeah. No spoilers. But you're on your phone, right? And you're kind of listening, kind of not listening. And then you hear them say the name of the character you like, phone down for a second. I'm tuned in.
Remember that time I accidentally spoiled Lost by telling a bad joke, like about what it wasn't supposed to be, and then people got mad because of anyway.
I don't.
It was a long time ago. It was on this show, but people wrote in and were angry that even at that point, the finale had been
years. I said Lost. The writers of Lost spoiled it.
I think I just said something to the effect of it was all a dream, which is not a spoiler because that's not true. And it's something the writers said they would never, ever do.
They would never do that.
Guys, I just want to say one last thing that comes directly from Johan Hari. I'm sorry. I've become a Hariite.
I love it.
And this, you can read this in The Guardian. The title is Your Attention Didn't Collapse. It Was Stolen. It was written January 2nd, 2022. This is just a quote from the end of the article. Read it, though, and get to this quote. He says, "At the moment, it's as though we're all having itching powder poured over us all day, and the people pouring the powder are saying, quote, you might want to learn to meditate. Then you wouldn't scratch so much. Meditation is a useful tool, but we actually need to stop the people who are pouring itching powder on us. We need to band together and take on the forces stealing our attention and take it back." I really like that.
I agree, because we've got to tease this. We've got to deliver on this tease. That same article has one of my favorite beginnings that I read in the way these things are introduced as concepts. It's all about talking to his godson and taking him on a trip to Graceland. It's amazing. Please do check it out. It's a banger, stem to stern, but that's what we're talking about when you said Graceland at the very top of tonight's show.
Well, and can I just really quickly just give a shout out to, I think, someone that we all admire who recently passed away, David Lynch, who is an incredible painter, artist, polymath, filmmaker, and thinker. And, you know, he was a huge proponent of transcendental meditation and the idea of needing that stillness in order to be able to kind of pluck these ideas out of sort of the cosmic ether. And I think we can learn a lot from him. And if anybody out there isn't super familiar, I do recommend, you know, looking up some of his interviews on the subject, because, you know, people like him and like Eckhart Tolle, for example, are folks that I think are really important when it comes to thinking about mindfulness and being able to kind of like shut off that part of our brain that craves that dopamine hit that we've been talking about.
Dude, Johan ends it with, "The more our attention degrades, the harder it will be to summon the personal and political energy to take on the forces stealing our focus."
And that's why they're stealing it, isn't it? That's the whole point. I mean, it is a conspiracy in many ways. I don't know if it started that way, but the way the technocrats are now like in league with the government, it just seems like that's just, they're going to push it even further. And the idea of taking over TikTok, using it as a propaganda. So I don't know.
I would call it, again, an accidental conspiracy. The first conclusion, social media is not going away. For many people, it is the internet. For many people, it is also their prime method of interacting. And then second, the science continues. How relatively new is this stuff? We have to remember, widespread online social media comms are a little young to have true longitudinal studies. It's going to be difficult to account for all the differing variables involved. But as everybody is wrestling with this, we can say for sure, no matter how the science works out, it's great to put your phone down once in a while. A long time if you can manage it. Slow day, weekend off, go outside, do something fun. Your brain will consider this exercise. And with each iteration, just like lifting some dumbbells, your attention span's going to get stronger. And I really don't think social media tycoons care if you know about this. Not yet, because they say people are already addicted. From their perspective, you're never going to get so fed up that a large number of people actually leave for good. And this is where we once again want to shout out the various authors and scholars and journalists that we've mentioned here. We also want to ask you, since you're the most important part of this show, what's your take on this? What's your experience? We raised a lot of questions that don't quite have answers yet outside of people's personal experience. So please share it with us. After we talked about how dangerous social media is, guess what? You can find us online.
Right. And Ben, you had also mentioned being interested in folks writing in about their experiences with flow state, you know, like tell us about a positive way or that you've counteracted some of the damaging effects of social media. You can find us all over the internet. We are Conspiracy Stuff on YouTube, where we have video content galore for your enjoyment. We also exist at that handle on X, FKA Twitter, and on Facebook with our Facebook group. Here's where it gets crazy. On Instagram and TikTok, however, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show, and we're also people. You can find me on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown. How about you, Ben?
Is it an individual or a group effort? There's one way to find out. Go to at wherever people use @, or go to the website Ben Bolin. Hey, if you don't like to sip the social beads, there are other ways to find us. But Matt, the masses are dying to know. Any update on social media?
My name is Matt Frederick, and we have a phone number. It is 1-833-STDWYTK. Why don't you call in and tell us what you think about a social media tycoon gaining full access to the federal payment system like he did yesterday as we record this? That makes me nervous. What do you think? When you call, give yourself a cool nickname and let us know if we can use your name and message on the air. You've got 3 minutes. Say whatever you want. Just, you know, do make it fun and exciting. If you've got something else to say, if you want to write it out, if you want to send us a link or maybe a picture, why not send us a good old-fashioned email? We are.
Ooh, let me hold off there for a second. Folks, please, please, please write in as well with your opinion on what kind of qualifications someone needs to create or destroy a federal department. And especially if you work on the front line, we want to thank everybody who wrote in to us with some of their experience with the recent, let's say, changes here in the U.S. To the degree that you are comfortable, let us know if anonymity is key. We are the entities that read every email we receive. Be well aware, yet unafraid, sometimes the void writes back. Join us out here in the dark. Conspiracy at iHeartRadio.com.
Everyone, have a great day.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You've heard about the Super Bowl's legendary pregame tailgate party where the biggest stars in music kick off football's biggest game. iHeartRadio is bringing the show to your radio for the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert starring Post Malone live from New Orleans. Super Bowl Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 Pacific. Watch on YouTube at youtube.com/NFL and hear it on the new and improved free iHeartRadio app, the exclusive audio home of the Super Bowl 59 YouTube tailgate concert.
Roku has what you need to make your college home away from home feel more like your own. Make your dorm the place to be with Roku TV, or bring a Roku streaming stick to easily access all your favorite free and premium content like iHeartRadio. Stream your favorite playlist with the Roku Vibe Setting Smart Light Strips to sync your music to millions of colors and make your dorm feel more like you. Make your dorm the place to be with Roku TV, streaming players, and smart lights. Head to Roku.com or your favorite retailer to deck out your dorm.
If you're looking for your next movie or show to watch, you could browse hundreds of entertainment reviews, ratings, and blogs. Or, if you're ready to get to the good stuff, just follow Xfinity on Instagram. Xfinity's entertainment experts do the work for you, bringing together TV recommendations, movie premieres, insider knowledge, and more. And not just the blockbusters. They've got all the deep cuts you'd otherwise miss, and recs on must-listen podcasts on iHeartRadio. Xfinity's a must-follow. Find them on Instagram now, and you'll never miss a beat.
Do you own a business that's ready to thrive? It's time to let Intuit QuickBooks take things like unpaid invoices and tracking expenses off your plate so you can take things to the next level. Intuit QuickBooks is an all-in-one business platform that can help with those day-to-day tasks like invoicing and expenses. Manage and grow your business all in one place. Intuit QuickBooks, your way to money. Money movement services are provided by Intuit Payments, Inc., licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services.